The Chief Executive of Nursing Homes Ireland is joining me, and Tadhg Daly is on the line. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
Tadhg, first things first, yourselves at Nursing Home Ireland, you're saying that you're under severe pressure at the moment within the sector. Just walk us through that before we get through anything else. What exactly is so hard to cope with at the moment? I'm assuming staff shortages.
Yeah, absolutely. Staffing is the single biggest concern now at this point in time. There's quite a number of staff, I suppose, who are out with COVID or indeed having been close contacts of COVID. Now, that has eased somewhat in the last couple of days as a result of the changing guidance. But I suppose that's the immediate issue with staffing. But there's also, I suppose, a challenge right across many sectors, and nursing homes are no different in terms of the availability of people to work in the sector. So the point we're making and have been making even pre-COVID was, you know, we need a fairly ambitious workforce plan for the sector to ensure that we have the numbers to be able to care for what is an ageing population.
Now, I was listening to the news earlier on, and there was a TD for Dublin talking about, you know, we're getting to this point of the pandemic is what this person was saying, that we need to learn to live with it better. And we need to, I guess, highlight and pick out who the most vulnerable in society is in terms of this virus. And in terms of any virus, aside from obviously immunocompromised people at risk with health things, one of the top people on the list would be those who are over a certain age. And those in nursing homes would be over a certain age, therefore more at risk for things like viruses, etc. If we look at March 2020 and May 2021, there was 2,349 deaths of nursing home residents with COVID-19. The first 15 months of the pandemic saw over 16,200 cases among nursing home residents. If the nursing home is a sector of the population, or is a group of the population that's the most at risk, going forward and living with COVID, which is clearly what we're doing, could there be things like rolling restrictions to do with visiting within the nursing home sector?
Yeah, I suppose, look, I mean, in terms of visiting, I think it's important that we try and keep nursing homes open for, you know, as long as it's humanly possible. I think everybody is pulling out all the stops to do that. I mean, what we have at the moment is there are increasing number of outbreaks, but two things which are very, very positive. One is that the number of residents who are infected by COVID are relatively low in pure numbers terms, and also the sickness level, if you like, or the illness is not presenting as acute. So that's the positives in terms of it. But you're right. I mean, the whole notion of living with COVID, I suppose what that says to us in the nursing home sector is that it's a change model of care, if you like. Nursing home is very much a social model of care. But in terms of living with COVID, you know, the infection control measures that are now in play will have to be, you know, maintained into a longer period. There's possibility of ongoing testing. There's possibility of, you know, further vaccines, whether it's a fourth booster or whether it's a new booster. There's talk of antiviral medication. So you're absolutely right. I mean, the nursing home sector and indeed older people generally took the brunt of COVID-19. So it's important now that we continue to be ahead of all those issues over the next while, that we're prepared, because we do see in other jurisdictions like Israel, for example, where they are introducing a fourth booster.
They're administering a fourth, yeah.
Yes, but we'll be guided by NIAC, the National Immunization.
Yeah, obviously you don't have
committee on that.
Yeah, you don't have specifics there, but one thing I do want to pull you up on, which I'm sure yourselves at Nursing Homes Ireland have thought, a different model of care. I guess that's a very good point, because the social model of nursing home care previously for the past, you know, however many hundreds of years, is obviously going to change when, you know, something like a pandemic comes along. So what are the potential changes that you could speak to our listeners this afternoon if they have loved ones in nursing homes, or they themselves maybe in the future can see themselves going into something like a nursing home? What would be the changes that you could speak about?
Well, I suppose that's the point I'm making, is that we need to be careful here, that you're right. I mean, a lot of the measures that have been introduced over the last while were to deal with a pandemic, you know, hopefully a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence in all our lives. So we need to be very careful here that we don't move into an over-medicalized or an over-clinical care setting, you know, purely on the basis of a pandemic. Clearly, we've got to maintain, you know, very intensified infection control procedures. But we do need to get back to living, you know, and kind of a relatively normal life within a nursing home. So visitors are important, activities, you know, all of those elements that were stood down in the early stages of the pandemic, many of those are coming back, thankfully, and we need to be able to maintain those into the future. So that's the point I'm making in terms of, you know, maybe we need testing on an ongoing basis. You know, so people, we need more vigilance, absolutely, and we cannot be complacent given the threat of the virus. But what we do need is to get back to a more normalised life within a nursing home, because it's the resident's own home.
Mm-hmm. And no disrespect to you, Tadhg, because obviously it's great speaking to yourself as Chief Executive of Nursing Homes Ireland. But what exactly are the residents saying? I know you can't speak for everybody, but those that have their opinions, what are you hearing in terms of, I guess, a potential new model that really we're already in, if we're being honest?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there's been quite a bit of research done, I suppose, over the last while in terms of dealing with the pandemic. But ultimately, this is a person's home. And what we've got to do is ensure that we can get back to that, you know, maybe not the traditional model of care.
I mean, they are top priority when it does come to any potential changes. And I'm assuming that they would be considered first and foremost.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, each nursing home, for example, would have residents' councils. You know, so the consultation with residents is hugely important. The other element is advocacy services. There's very many advocacy services now that advocate on behalf of those in nursing homes. So absolutely, you're 100% right. What we need to ensure here is that the voice of the resident is heard absolutely loud and clear. And what they're saying to us from talking to members is that, you know, the visitor restrictions bore very hard on them. And while at the time it was appropriate, we do need to move away from that now, because, you know, we can't get into a period whereby, you know, every time there's an outbreak or every time there's an increase in cases, that the default becomes no more than the default and the community at large is lockdown. We can't get into a position either of introducing rolling restrictions in nursing homes, because it's their home ultimately. They need to see family, friends, and it creates a sense of community and a vibe within a nursing home that is hugely, hugely important. So getting that balance right is always tricky, and the balance of the safety and welfare of residents and staff against the threat of the virus. But that's a shared responsibility. It's a responsibility of providers and staff, a responsibility of visitors as well, so and residents, obviously, in terms of maintaining that safety.
Okay, well, Tadhg Daly, thank you for your time this afternoon, Chief Executive of Nursing Homes Ireland. I'd love to hear what you think. Have you got a loved one in a nursing home, or are you yourself listening in from a nursing home? Because really, it is the residents that we should hear from the most on things like this. And obviously, it's great to hear from people like Tadhg in terms of, you know, being so high up within the sector and Nursing Homes Ireland in itself. But I guess the residents in general aren't people that we've heard from enough throughout this pandemic. So do let me know if you have anybody in particular that has something to say, or you yourself. The text line and the call line is, I'll go with the text line first, it's 0833 97 97 97, and to call it's 0459 01490. Now moving to a very different age group, the president of the ISSU joins me now, Eimear Neville. Good afternoon to you, Eimear.
Good afternoon, how are you?
I am grand, thank you very much. 68% of Leaving Cert students would like to see the return of the hybrid model for this year's exams. And to be honest, I don't think people should be surprised by this. Exactly, Eimear, why are yourselves and others, or yourself in Leaving Cert, choosing, I guess, to have that opinion?
Well, students have faced an absolute mountain of disruptions over the course of their senior cycle. From school closures in 2020 and 2021, from missed tuition time currently due to the mass absenteeism that we're seeing in schools, and right up to the just unacceptable levels and situation that the classrooms are in at the moment, from closed or open windows where students are freezing and unable to concentrate, to the general disruptions that you would face in a pandemic, such as mental health pressures, and so on. These students have suffered enough, I think, over the last 3 or 4 years now, and deserve to have a choice that works for them.
Eimear,
and they've very clearly shown us what that is.
Eimear, talk me through your senior cycle.
So what students are asking for is essentially a...
No, talk me through your experience with your senior cycle in secondary school. What happened while you were going through senior cycle? Like, talk me through the time frame in terms of the pandemic, etc.
Well, I actually sat my senior cycle last year in 2021. Mm-hmm. But it was quite similar to this, where, you know...
Yeah, but obviously, so you're in fifth year when the pandemic hits, is that correct?
Yeah, so okay. You're in fifth year, the pandemic comes in and, well, the school's closed. for a few months, and you don't really understand what is going on, because the pandemic is so new, and you're still learning new things about the virus and how it develops. And then suddenly, you know, you don't go back to school. The school's closed right up until the summer. Suddenly you're in sixth year. Then, you know, you're facing further school closures. You're facing mass tuition lost because of the mass absenteeism from teachers and students who are contracting the virus or who are having to self-isolate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's very little changes made to the papers to account for all of this.
And so, Emer, just in regards to fifth year, I had this conversation with people before, and I don't know if everybody agrees with me here, but I feel like in fifth year, you're kind of learning everything, and sixth year is all about revision and, you know, getting the papers right, etc. And people like yourself who were in fifth year had a real, you know, turmoil in itself. That is something that I think people aren't taking into consideration, rather than just the Leaving Cert exam period, because it is literally 2 years of senior cycle. And those who are in Leaving Cert this year will have only been in senior cycle when a pandemic is in place.
Absolutely. And, you know, you're dead right when you're saying that fifth year is where most of the content is taught. It's where you're really getting your grounds for these exams. And sixth year is, you know, getting the last few bits together and revision. And making sure that you remember everything that went on in fifth year. And for a lot of these students, like you said, they've never experienced that in a normal way, where there hasn't been some form of school closure or mass absenteeism or anything like that. You know, they've never experienced the normal senior cycle. So it would be incredibly unfair to give them the normal senior cycle.
And Emer, do you believe that this hybrid model will be put back in place for Leaving Cert 2022 with the conversations you've had thus far?
I hope so. I think students have very clearly shown that they need some sort of change, such as the hybrid model, to really account for what they've faced. There are loads of other stakeholders calling for this. The principals, who really as well have come out and talked about the mass disruptions that they themselves, who are in the school with students, understand that students are going through. And, you know, as the as principals are, you know, at the very top of the school community, you know, they see it all and they know exactly what students have faced, and are very open to coming out and saying that. So I think we really need to be listening to all stakeholders in these discussions and coming together to find solutions such as a hybrid model that will work for students.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me this afternoon. That's the president of the Irish Second Level Students Union, Emer Neville. Thank you, and have a good rest of your day. And obviously, in terms of those in senior cycle and Leaving Cert in particular, 68% of them would like to see the return of the hybrid model for this year's exams. Okay, so you may have heard a lot of people speaking about Blue Monday. So what exactly is it? So back in 2005, this is the history now, Sky Travel used an equation. They tried to calculate the saddest day of the year using things such as weather, the debt levels, time since Christmas and motivation. Even though obviously some people don't love Christmas, so I'm almost surprised by using Christmas as one of those things. Anyway, the date supposedly was the third Monday of January, which this year is today, and it's the 17th. And it was a term created for a press release, but psychologists say there is something to it. Now, I'm speaking to the volunteer with 50808 now, Stephen McCarthy. How are you, Stephen?
Hi, Gara. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining me. Listen, first thing before we go into this, what exactly is 50808? Because a lot of people will be confused.
Yeah, 50808 is a crisis text line. So anybody, for whatever reason, can text in to get support or to just for help, or even sometimes if they're just lonely and want to chat. So it's a text-based service rather than a phone call, which tends to suit a lot of people.
Yeah,
that's pretty much what we are.
Probably a lot of the younger age cohort as well would be quicker to text.
Very much so, yes.
Stephen, I think everybody's affected by, you know, obviously this pandemic, but we've had such high rates of COVID over the past few months that it's been really difficult for people just to hear that. And any other day of the year, the third Monday in January is always going to be known as Blue Monday, but we're in the middle of a pandemic as well. And we've heard from two different sectors within the show. First, we heard from Nursing Homes Ireland, and obviously they're facing a lot in terms of case numbers and what they went through previously at the first wave of the pandemic, in terms of now staff shortages. And then we were speaking with Leaving Cert students. So a big difference in the age range there. So everybody has been affected by this pandemic, some people very badly. And putting a day like this into the equation, it doesn't make things easier for a lot of people.
No, it wouldn't. No, and I know what you're saying, that psychologists have kind of agreed that this is the most depressing day of the year, I think is the phrase that that's been used. But certainly this day last year on the platform, I wasn't a volunteer myself at the time, but we had 40% of texters on this day texting in with anxiety and another 20% with depression. So there's over half of the texters on that one day alone with those two main kind of issues, mental health issues. So it definitely does impact. And yes, yeah, certainly over the last 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks, there has been a number, particularly the younger people, kind of student age, secondary school students, texting in quite anxious, and particularly coming back to when school is reopening as well. So yes, it does. The pandemic certainly hasn't helped.
Obviously, getting in touch with a crisis text line like 50808, people will give advice. We're speaking to lots of people here. So what are the main bits of advice that you could give to people right now if they're finding not only today, but the past few weeks really difficult? And one of the things I keep going back to, because I am finding it so difficult, I'm such a social person, and, you know, being cut off from people and always having that worry at the back of your head is very draining. And I keep thinking in my head, control the controllables. And I'm assuming that's probably the advice you'd give to our listeners.
Yes. You can control the controllables, but sometimes you just need to talk to somebody to figure out what it is you can control. And that's kind of the service we provide. So we are, our goal is to help somebody get to a calm moment from a hot moment. And quite often that can be just by talking and just by chatting and kind of... Very often people would know what they need to do themselves, they just need to hear it. And so the service we provide kind of fills that gap. So I know we are providing kind of support in the moment, but we can link in with further longer term supports as well for the texters if they choose to.
Okay, well, Stephen, it's a great service, and it's a text line, as Stephen is saying. You can text whatever it is. It's to 50808. And Stephen, when people do text, what is kind of the time range, I guess, for them to receive a response? Is it literally within seconds, minutes?
It'll be usually within 1 or 2 minutes.
Okay.
Get a text response.
So pretty immediate.
Pretty immediate, yes. So there's always a team on of volunteers, of crisis volunteers. So we're all trained as crisis volunteers. And there's also supervisors there who are trained professional counsellors as well to kind of support the volunteers. But yes, so there's always a team on, and we aim to have everyone, a conversation started within a couple of minutes of somebody texting in.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Stephen McCarthy, volunteer with 50808. And thank you for volunteering, obviously helping so many people throughout Ireland. And if you are somebody who's finding today particularly difficult, one of the main things people say, as Stephen was mentioning, is to talk. And if you don't want to talk to anybody in particular, try and find somebody within your circle. Talk to friends, family, co-worker, whatever it is. If even the 50808 line, it's there for a reason, and obviously these people want to help, they're volunteering, so do get in touch with things like that. Also, if you don't want to, if you're feeling today, would say in particular, that, you know, you don't really want to talk, get outside. That's one of the main things that's coming up on all these different forums I'm looking up in terms of Blue Monday. They're saying get outdoors, get some sunlight. Obviously, it's still shorter winter days, it's still cold, and get some exercise. I know you might want to do it, but it does have an effect on our mood. So that's the advice. I hope you're doing well, because I think everybody is struggling. I know the past few weeks I have found really difficult. But we got to keep going, and we got to keep doing this and stick together, and reach out for help in all the different avenues that are available for you and to you. So do keep your text coming in this afternoon, 0833 97 97 97. Some music now. Defence Force personnel is something that is a continuous topic within this country and on this station. Joining me now is Commandant Conor King, the General Secretary of RACO. Good afternoon to you, Conor.
Good afternoon, Kira. How are you?
I am grand, thank you very much. So I'm reading this article here in the Irish Examiner. It came out on Friday. So a failure by the Commission on Defence to recommend major solutions to retention issues in the military will only lead to further departures. And the Defence Force needs 700 new recruits per year to reach full strength. Are we anywhere near that at the moment, Conor?
Unfortunately, we're not, Kira. So if I bring you back to
some of the reviews and the commissions and white papers and defence that we've had over the last number of years. And, you know, the government has been trying hard to fix the retention crisis in the defence forces. But, you know, even when we've been able to achieve something like 700 people brought into the organisation, which happened, I think, in 2017, we lost about 850 that year. And over the last 5 years, we've actually brought in 3,100 and lost 3,700. So really, it's proof positive that we can't recruit our way out of a retention crisis. And the reason that we tried to submit that data to the Commission on the Defence Forces, which is currently conducting its final deliberations, is that we've proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that even if we do get to 700 people coming in every year and the amount of resources that's required to train all those people, unless we bring the turnover rate, i.e. the rate of people leaving the organisation, highly skilled people leaving the organisation every day, unless we bring that rate down, we're just running to stand still. In fact, we're actually in reverse. And, you know, unless we actually bring in retention initiatives that we've actually suggested to the Commission, then really we're at nothing.
I'm assuming pay is one of the major issues. Would say in terms of the percentage, I guess, of the Defence Force members of this country that are owed pay, would it be quite high? Would it be over 50%?
Who are owed pay? Well, you see, pay is a funny one because as all public sector personnel, you know, we're bound by national pay agreements from the centre. So
Yeah. Basic
pay is difficult to argue for outside of pay negotiations. Now, if we spoke another day, I could go on for an hour about our treatment of pay negotiations, but I won't bore the listeners with that. What I will say is, though, that there are very specific defence sector allowances that we could be looking at. And when you ask about whether there are a number of people who are owed money, you only have to look down the road in the Curragh camp at the Army Ranger Wing, who had an adjudication which was won by PD4, actually, in 2010, and they haven't been paid yet. You know, they are owed, some of them, multiples of thousands of
euros. Yeah, how much are we talking, would say, on average for a Ranger Wing member?
On average, I couldn't put a number on it. I have heard of certain individuals who are owed upwards of 30,000 euros, and it's not in single figures.
Well, it's actually quite hard to believe that. If we look at our Defence Forces, we're currently 1,000 personnel short of the minimum strength. Now, many people in this country would argue that obviously we're a peaceful nation by and large, and we're neutral. Well, I know we've gotten involved with the European Army in the past year or so, isn't it? But by and large, a lot of people say, you know, what's the point of the Army? Just highlight to our listeners what it means if we're 1,000 personnel short of our minimum strength in this country.
Well, it's the age-old question, what do you need the defence forces for, or an armed force? And if I could make it as simple as possible by saying that we are the state's national insurance policy. So if you ask the average listener, you know, if you didn't have to pay for insurance, how many people would actually take the chance and actually drive without insurance or not put insurance on their house or pay for travel insurance? We are the state's national insurance policy because we're not that visible and we're there as a contingent capability in times of pandemic or in times of flood, or to project our foreign policy overseas, or to provide a backup to local authorities, or to provide a backup or security to an Garda Síochána. Because we're there waiting to be called, sometimes we're not as visible to people. So that's the answer to that one. Why do we need the defence forces? Now, what does it mean for an organisation which is supposed to have a minimum of 9,500 who are over 1,000 people short? It means that you're absolutely struggling all the time. People are firefighting, people are double and treble jobbing, and that kind of precipitates a dysfunctional cycle of turnover where you look around and you see that you're actually doing two or three jobs.
Yeah.
And that leads to stress and burnout, low morale, and people look around and say, well, actually, with the lack of stability I have in the job, maybe I'm better off going somewhere else where my skills might be rewarded.
And obviously just the basics that the times we live in now with staff shortages due to this virus. I'm sure the Defence Force have not been hit by this. And just another reason why there's so many people probably bogged under with work, etc. Look, Conor, we could speak about this for a lot longer. And it's something that obviously it's not going away anytime soon, it seems. But just to reiterate something you said, did you say in the past 10 years 3,700 left and 3,100 were recruited? Is that right in terms of personnel numbers?
Yeah, in the most recent 5 year period.
In five years.
In a 5 year period,
okay.
So we've lost a net. And if I bring it back to the likes of the Public Service Commission, I see that without
Connor, unfortunately, there you're breaking up. Your line has just gone on us there. But as Connor was saying, Defence Forces need 700 new recruits per year to reach full strength. We're currently 1,000 personnel short of minimum strength for the Defence Forces of this country. That was Commandant Connor King of Araco there, who's joined us many times before, but unfortunately just breaking up towards the end of the phone call. Okay, it is Blue Monday, and if you are struggling, I want to go through some more things that you can do for yourself. We were mentioning earlier going outside, exercising, and speaking to people. They're three of the main things. Some of the other things that I'm seeing: discover a new podcast. I don't know if many of you are into the podcast. Indulge in retail therapy. They say responsibly here. I wouldn't mind indulging in some retail therapy. Try a new recipe. Maybe try something different for dinner. Do a good deed. That always makes you feel good when you do a good deed, isn't it? So see if you can do something like that out there today. Plan something fun for the future. I know many of you may say, what future? We're locked in, restrictions, etc., etc. It's going to get better. It's going to get better. Put out the positive vibes. So try and plan something fun for the future, because I think it does always make you feel better when you have plans. Treat it like a Friday night, it's saying here. So maybe, you know, get yourself a takeaway, do something extra nice for yourself. They're saying light a fire. It is cold. It was very cold last night on the way in at 7:30 this morning. It was -4 in my car. I couldn't believe it. Have a bubble bath. I think I might do that one this evening, is have a bath. I haven't had a bath in a while. So good, baths. And then sleep in fresh sheets. That's one of the best you can do. I love fresh sheets. Need to do that all the time. So that's some advice. Also, listen to music. Some of you are texting in regards to the competition for the Mystery Voices. It's three people. Some of you are just texting in one name. It's three different people within that clip. Now, speaking of money, Irish billionaires, their wealth increased by 18 billion euro during the pandemic. Joining me to discuss this is the chief executive of Oxfam Ireland, Jim Clarkin. Good afternoon to you, Jim.
Good afternoon, Ciara. How are you?
I'm grand. I'm not as well as Ireland's billionaires, though. 18 billion euro during what, 22 months? Absolutely crazy.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And our report out today is not just looking at billionaires in Ireland or billionaires across the world. The 10 wealthiest billionaires, who are all men, have doubled their wealth in that same period. So there's been an extraordinary spike in the wealth of very, very wealthy people during the course of the pandemic, when 99% of the rest of the world has gotten poorer. Life has been difficult for almost everybody else. And the purpose of the report really is to highlight that kind of gross inequality. And these aren't just numbers. These have huge, huge impacts on people. I mean, we see that inequality across the world kills about 21,000 people every day, through lack of access to healthcare, through hunger, through crisis. We see that, you know, that it has had a profound effect on women this past nearly 2 years now. The ILO estimate that $800 billion has been lost by women in income across the world. Mm-hmm. Women have shouldered the burden of all the additional care responsibility, because women do the vast majority of care, unpaid care work. And we estimate that 20 million girls who left school because of the pandemic won't go back. And then there's been this extraordinary increase in violence against women and girls across the world during the course of the pandemic. So it has what has happened in the last 2 years has really exacerbated inequalities that already existed and really put pressure on people, and has been very, very difficult for a lot of people. And we just think there's a way we can look to redress that balance.
Yeah, so Jim, the first thing I want to ask you is about the world's richest people, which happens to be 10 men. They more than doubled their fortune from 610 billion euro to 1.3 billion euro at a rate of 1.13 billion a day. That was during the first 2 years of the pandemic. We're just coming up to the 2 year mark around now. There's been this argument made, Jim, and I'd like, you know, for yourself, somebody with such background in this, to discuss it, that these men, or the richest people, it's not in regards to their gender in this point, but would they be able to solve things like world hunger with their wealth? Because a lot of people argue, say, oh, would not be a possibility whatsoever. For someone like yourself, just tell us, how much would it actually cost the world to solve world hunger?
Well, what I can tell you is that the increase in wealth, not the overall wealth, but the increase in wealth that these individuals, those 10 individuals, had over that period.
Which I'll just highlight again is from 610 billion to 1.3 trillion.
That's right, yeah. I mean, that would have paid to vaccinate everybody in the world. It would have paid to provide free health access to people across 80 countries across the world. These are huge, huge sums of money. They make a massive, massive difference. And as I say, this is just the increases. So, I mean, you know, the that level of gross inequality, first of all, these guys can never spend that money, not in a million lifetimes. So it's money that is not being put to any kind of productive use. Whereas if we introduced what we were calling for as a wealth tax mm-hmm. on the billionaires and multimillionaires, we could generate a lot of money to invest in social protection, in healthcare, in Ireland's case, in housing. And
okay, Jim, I just want to pick you up there on the wealth tax because it's something that is a hot topic over in the States. And again, the arguments have been things like, oh, these people already spend, you know, billions of euros or dollars, whatever it is, whatever country you're paying your taxes in already. Why should they have to pay more, et cetera, et cetera? But when we see people like this, and people might hate me for saying something like this, but obviously, every single person in the world, especially this side of the world, we're very privileged. We're able to go to school. I know we've many problems, but the things compared to, you know, third world countries, we are in privileged positions. And you look at people who are some of the richest in the world and they're taking flights to space while other people can't even eat food. It is a hard pill to swallow and to look at. And this argument against wealth taxes is kind of hard to hold up, I guess.
It really is, and the behaviour of some of these individuals is obscene when you look at what the rest of the world has gone through, and particularly people in poorer parts of the world. You know, it makes no sense. I mean, they may not have the solutions to world hunger and world conflict, but actually, if they participate in a more meaningful way, they can make a huge, huge difference. And by the way, there is a very large public support for wealth taxes, so it isn't just Oxfam. And by the way, the IMF and the OECD and others are looking at this as well. But it isn't just us. I mean, the vast majority of the population think that this is necessary because, you know, first of all, some form of a one-off tax for the extreme additional wealth accumulated by wealthy people during this last 2 years when everybody else's wealth went down and incomes went down. But also a longer-term tax on extreme wealth that just redistributes. I mean, at the end of the day, this wealth doesn't happen by accident. It happened because of the work of people within the companies that these people work for. It happened because of monopolistic situations that they find themselves in and so on. So it has had an impact elsewhere. So it's only right and proper that this wealth would be redistributed in some form or way. This isn't some kind of an anti-wealth kind of position or anti-people who make money position, but it's just how is it shared more fairly. Yeah. And we even have billionaires and millionaires now themselves, there are groups of them who are calling for greater taxes. They acknowledge that this is problematic, that the systems that are put in place are not fair to normal people and that they don't think it's right either. Yeah. So we're starting to see a movement now towards this, and we think Ireland should be part of that movement.
Yeah, Jim, it's a very interesting topic. I just want to highlight again, Oxfam estimates that a 1.5% wealth tax on just the Irish millionaires owning above 4 million euro could raise 4 billion euro in tax revenue. And a 1.5% wealth tax on Irish billionaires alone could raise a little over 0.7 billion euro. It's quite incredible when you do look at the figures. Thank you very much. That's the Chief Executive of Oxfam Ireland there, Jim Clarkin, with some very interesting stats.